accession number 19673, reel 1.
Gordon Graham, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Glasgow.
Which year was this?
1920.
Did you grow up and have your education in Glasgow?
Yes, I went to an ancient grammar school which was established in Greenfields near the River Clyde in the 1640s, but by the time I went there it was in the heart of the Gorbals. It was called Hutchison's Grammar School. And I went there from 1928, after I finished primary school, until the sixth form, which would be 1937. I graduated from the school then and went to Glasgow University.
To study what?
Law. In Scotland, you take 2 degrees to become legally qualified. You start with a Master of Arts, which lasts for 3 years. This is followed by an LLB, which is a 2-year course. For some reason, I wanted to be an advocate, which is the Scottish term for barrister, as you know. And so I started with my Master of Arts degree in the autumn of 1937. The subjects I took were Greek philosophy, because I'd been to a classical school and I'd had a lot of Latin and Greek over my secondary school years. And it was 2 years later, 2 years after I went to the university, that the war broke out. 3rd of September, 1939. And I must say, looking back, it took me entirely by surprise. I didn't think it was going to happen. We had had all of the alarms over Hitler and so on in 1938, and it had gone away. And perhaps being by nature an optimist and not being very internationally politically aware, I didn't even know that the country had an army, quite frankly. But anyway, 2 days later I joined, on the 5th of September, 1939. Then I awaited my call-up papers, and to my astonishment and dismay, the government said I should complete my university course before they called me up. That is surely an indication of the lack of urgency or lack of readiness that the British government had in 1939. They had more volunteers than they could handle, and so they decided not only that I, but that any undergraduate who was in the last year of his course should complete his studies before being called up. So paradoxically, having volunteered to defend my country, I found myself back at my studies and did indeed take my MA degree in June of 1940. But even then, I had to remind the government that I was anxious to defend my country. And by this time, there was a considerably greater sense of urgency, as you can imagine, because this was post-Dunkirk. So I actually had to write to the War Office and say, will you please send me my papers, which they finally did. And I was called up on my 20th birthday, 17th of July, 1940. And I'd volunteered for the infantry, by the way. It seemed the best place to be.
Had the war affected you at all before then?
Yes and no. Nothing in the way of danger. It was a constant preoccupation in everybody's mind. and of course there was considerable deprivation of creature comforts. And a few bombs were dropped on Glasgow, but nothing near to where I was staying. The most exciting event I recall, this was after I was called up in the vicinity of my home, was that Rudolf Hess descended by parachute 2 miles from my home. Which, of course, it was all kept greatly secret, but that was an interesting historical footnote. So I was called into the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, who have their barracks at Strensall, outside of York. And I was given my basic training there for the next 4 months. I had been identified as what they called a potential officer, which means they might send you to officer cadet training school if you came through your basic training displaying whatever qualities they were looking for. And that's what happened in November 1940. I was sent to the officer cadet training unit at Dunbar in Scotland, where I spent the four winter months of 40-41. So I was commissioned in February 1941.
Anything you can record of note that happened to you at Dunbar?
Yes, it was quite brutal, and I guess quite intentionally so. There was a sergeant major of whom everybody was scared, and you got very little sleep and were constantly on night exercises. And the standards were very high. You were graded at the end A, B, C, D, E, or F. And there were no A's. There were three B's, of whom I was one. And then those who were not considered, some were sent back to the ranks from the cadet training school.
Did it surprise you what kind of things they were looking for in an officer?
No. They were looking for initiative, leadership, physical endurance, all these things. However, this was still the product of the regular army, so they were creating an officer class, as it were, though I was unconscious of this at the time. But when I was posted to my battalion, which was the 1st Battalion of the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders, I realized that there was a considerable gulf between the professional regular army officers who had been in the army before the war and the wartime soldiers like me and the others.
In what sense?
Mental attitudes. We were much more democratic and I think probably less ready to be regimented. There was, in fact, a third group. Between them, there were the territorial army officers who regarded themselves as being sort of privileged because they had been preparing for the war, whereas people like me had only thought about military service in the light of the outbreak of war. So we did all kinds of things that were wrong, you know. Conventions that we either didn't know about or didn't care about.
Can you give some examples?
Well, in the officer's mess, you always had to stand up when a senior officer entered the room, and the senior officers had their own chairs, and you only spoke to them when they spoke to you, and that sort of thing. And all the silly conventions about passing the port to the left at dinner, these were things that were strange to us, but which was still practiced right in the heart. This was 1941. The battalion had been at Dunkirk and had been decimated there. So we were, we and many conscripts from South Yorkshire were filling the gaps and bringing the battalion back up to strength. Of course, not just the battalion, but the whole of the British 2nd Division was stationed there. And the battalion was one of 9 battalions in that division.
Did you feel inclined to conform to these conventions, or did you wish to kick over the traces?
Well, you were under discipline. It wasn't run as a democracy, so you conformed. You did what was required, but you had your private thoughts. Particularly, I think, in the relationship between the officers and the men, under the regular army's philosophy, these were like two different kinds of human beings, whereas my generation, my non-military generation, tended to regard the men as our equals. I think I was, in fact, one of the first officers in the British Army to have the men call me by my first name off parade, not on parade. On parade it was Sir and Lieutenant Graham and so on, but off parade we went out together. I said call him by my first name, and they did. But I don't think the senior officers would have approved of this very much. But it seemed obvious to me that if you're well in a team, the camaraderie has to be democratic. So I enjoyed that very much.
Where were you with this battalion?
In a mining town called Thorne, Thorne, which is south of York, back again to Yorkshire, where I had joined up. And I remember that when I arrived, officers were billeted out in private homes, you know. And so the first day I was there, I went into a pub and standing next to a fellow and said I was looking for a billet. He said, oh, come home, I'll put you up. He turned out to be the local mine owner who had a very beautiful mansion. I had a wonderful bedroom with oriel windows. And so I fell in my... They all got the same amount of money, you see, no matter what the quality of the accommodation was. And it was unfortunate, perhaps, that billeted next door to me in a small cottage was the second in command of the battalion, who frowned heavily when he saw me emerging from this mine owner's mansion. These are the sort of things that one unconsciously got wrong. So it was not exactly a popularity contest. You had to win your way. But in the battalion, they did respect efficiency. And whatever they regarded as leadership.
How were the mine owners getting on with the local miners in those days?
Something similar to the regular army and the private soldiers, I would think. Yeah. These were days the class system was undisturbed. And of course the war was a great... demolisher of class. I was participating in this, you know. The whole of society was changing under pressure of the war.
What happened to you next?
Well, it was a somewhat anticlimactic. We went on coastal defense in Yorkshire, which was a dreary business, especially in the winter. We did 48-hour route marches and prepared for something to happen, and it didn't happen. And this went on for a year.
Whereabouts was it on the Yorkshire coast?
Between Bridlington and Scarborough, I think, on the cliffs there. You know, it was barbed wire on the sand below, and you had trenches on top of the cliffs, and you had a 24-hour watch, of course, because invasion was still possible. The peak of the invasion scare was 16th September 1940, when I was a private soldier, when they really thought the Germans were landing. But for the next 2 or 3 years, it was still regarded as possible.
So this is Filey, Hunman Bay, Flotman Bay?
Yes, that whole coastline east of York, really, down to the Humber. Then we were transferred to Oxfordshire, preparatory to being posted overseas. All of this was prepared in great secrecy, of course, and we didn't know where we were going. But when you get lined up, as we did in the village of Adderbury, which is outside of Oxford, and inspected by His Majesty the King, you know that he's only come down to say goodbye. So, and we all got on a train to Liverpool, where we got onto a troop ship.
Can you tell me about the voyage out?
Yes, it lasted for 2 months. We sailed west from Liverpool in convoy, of course. Till we were quite close to the coast of the United States. Then we turned south in the direction of Brazil and then east to Freetown. This was the regular route to avoid the U-boat. So it took a long time. We stopped in Freetown. We didn't get off. And we stopped again in Cape Town, where we did get off. And
what was the name of the ship?
It was called the Marnix van der Sint Aldegonde. It was a Dutch cruise liner. The officers traveled quite well. We were six in a cabin, it's true, but we had cabins and we had officers' mess. The men were accommodated in hammocks in the lower decks, and particularly when we got into the tropics, they had a terrible time. The temperature was up to 115 degrees sometimes in below decks at night. Then we assumed we were on our way to North Africa, which indeed we were. But meanwhile, there had been some rather alarming developments in the Far East. This is early 42. And while we were at sea, the Japanese conquered Burma pretty well. Yes, while we were at sea. And although I do not have any evidence of it, I assume that is why our entire division was diverted. Instead of going to Port Said and North Africa, was diverted to India. It was just a historical chance. And 15,000 British soldiers arrived in Bombay to the surprise of the Indian Army, I think.
Which month did you arrive, do you think?
June 1942. We lay out in Bombay Harbour for 10 days because they didn't know what to do with us. And when we got ashore, we were shipped up to a muddy field outside of Pune, I would say, where we had to pitch tents in darkness and generally look after ourselves on rather meager rations. They had plenty of potatoes and onions, I remember. But the arrival in Bombay, on the other hand, was quite a magical experience because we got ashore into this exotic city where none of us had ever been before. But one of my friends had a friend, an Indian Muslim, had been at school with him. So we called him up and he took us out to Juhu Beach and we had a great time and got back to the ship at 5 a.m. But we were supposed to have gotten back at 11 p.m. So three subalterns were carpeted by the adjutant in front of the CO, who naturally assumed we had been to brothels. actually been doing something which she disapproved of even more, which was meeting Indians.
In what way did you get in touch with Indians?
Through this this friend who was at school with my friend, you see, we just called him up, and he gave us hospitality. You see, and we met all his family and so on.
What passed between you?
Oh, just conversation.
Was it just chit-chat, or was it about the political situation?
Oh, no, nothing political. It was purely social. It was just the way friends would meet, and he was saying, let me show you my towns. That was my introduction to India, where indeed I was to spend the next 14 years of my life.
What kind of impression did India leave you with?
You mean make on me immediately, or...
Well, after a time.
Oh, my reaction was, you know, I was a practicing liberal in the 1930s, and I was quite horrified at the conventions of the empire. When you first got off the boat and walked into Bombay, my watch had stopped, so I went into a jeweler's and said, could he mend my watch? And he was a Sikh. And he said, sure, and gave me a receipt. And so I said, now, can you direct me to the police station? He said, what do you want at the police station? I said, well, we want to look up a friend. We thought the police might know his address. And he said, listen, he said, the police in this country are not here to help you, and neither are you here to help us. That was my beginning of my political education, the resentment of the Indians of British rule. And indeed he was right, because 2 months after we landed was the Congress rebellion of August 1942, and we were pointing our bayonets at white-capped, defenseless Indian demonstrators in a town in South India.
Whereabouts?
Guntur, G-U-N-T-U-R, near to Bezwada, in what was then Madras State, is now Tamil Nadu, where there had been riots, you see, and the police had called for military help.
About how many demonstrators were you confronted by?
Thousands, I suppose. Thousands.
And what form did it take?
Oh, we just looked menacing, and they retreated. There had been some firing the day before, but we had not participated in this, thank goodness. So actually, I was ashamed. I was ashamed of British rule in India.
Were your feelings shared by your brother officers? Or
No. I think this was my own personal reaction. Most of them accepted all of the flesh pots of the officers' life in Indian barracks, so long as we were not in action quite cheerfully and understandably, too. But I was saved from the conventional military life by the exigencies of war. As I said a few minutes ago, the Japanese had just conquered Burma, and they were afraid there would be an invasion of India. And by this time, British military authorities realized that there must be something wrong with their traditional tactics. They had been defeated soundly in Malaya and in Burma by forces that were numerically inferior. So there was a lot of rethinking going on, and one of the decisions was that there should be special units in each battalion dedicated to guerrilla warfare. That's to say, to close quarter fighting in isolation away from the main battle, because the Japanese tactics had been constantly to outflank, surround, and make the retreat hazardous. And basically what was realized was that when you're surrounded, you stand fast and fight. And this was that was the beginning of this realization. So for the next period, about a year, I was able to live on the land in India, in the villages, meet the villagers, along with my 15 toughs. And we lived in the land, we practiced jungle lore, we taught ourselves to live in the jungle, and we practiced things like unarmed combat and so on. Well, the side benefit of this for me, referring to my political attitudes to the empire, was that I got to know the Indians in their villages, and that's where the real India is. That was an unexpected dividend from what was purely military training. I came to appreciate the Indian villager.
Were you able to communicate with him?
I learned some Hindi, yes. But of course there's so many languages that it's hard to communicate, but it's amazing how one can communicate without language, particularly when we were buying food or asking for information. You can do it by sign language.
Did the Indian villager have a similar attitude to the Sikh watchmaker in Bombay?
No, that's the whole point. They are... The Indian village was, and to a large extent is today, a self-contained and largely self-sufficient community. There's a village culture. There's a story that there was an Aboriginal tribe not far from Bombay in the Western Ghats, where after India attained independence, the Congress Party sent out survey teams, and one of the questions was, are things better now the British have left? And the reply was, who are the British? I mean, the Indian villages went on through, I suppose, back to the days of the Mughal Empire and through the British Empire in their own self-contained life. And something admirable, and something from which I think we can still learn things today.
Which particular villages were you in?
Oh, you mean what part of the country? All in, western India, on the borders of Goa, around Belgaum, further into south. Wherever there was jungle, that was where we had to train. I also went on several jungle warfare training courses. One was in Assam, on the banks of the river Tista, just where it emerges from the Himalayas. And that was primary jungle, where again we were being encouraged to be self-sufficient. That, in fact, was where I met my first American, because he was also on the course. And that was an interesting experience, too.
In what sense?
America was the